All right, so I'm going to talk about large-scale bias and primordial non-Gaussianity. And this is work with NYU student Keith Chan, Mark Manera, who's a postdoc at NYU, Lam Hui, who is an undergraduate student at NYU, and myself. So here is the outline of the talk. So I'll, as most of you know, if you look at the bias of tracers in models where you have primordial non-Gaussianity of the local type, you see that the bias is scale-dependent. And there are basically three derivations in the literature that get this result, which is the peak background split, peaks in a Gaussian field, and local Eulerian bias. So I'll discuss the similarities and the differences between these three models and trying to address where are these models are equivalent, and if not, which one is the right one. And then I'll discuss what happens when you have models of non-local non-Gaussianity, which is the expected type of non-Gaussianity in single-field inflationary models. I'll discuss some predictions for how the bias behaves for tracers and comparison with simulations. And then towards the end, I will discuss how to go beyond, going beyond the power spectrum. How does the bias spectrum help you in constraining primordial non-Gaussianity? Okay, so let me start with the simplest model that has been studied extensively. So it's a local model in which the Bardeen potential, capital phi, is just a simple local quadratic dependence on some Gaussian field, little phi, with a nonlinear parameter FNL. If you calculate the three-point function of this, the bias spectrum B, you see that it's quadratic in the power spectrum. By P1 and P2, I mean P of K1, P of K2, and so on. So there are three cyclic terms there. And interestingly, when you consider the bias of tracer objects, such as galaxies and halos, originally was found by Dalal et al. That the linear bias that you see as a function of scale actually presents the standard scale independent bias at large scales, and a component, an extra component which depends on primordial non-Gaussianity, and that becomes large as you go to low k. There are basically three derivations of this effect in the literature, and I want to take a look at how they differ and how they agree. The first one that I'm listing here, and there are many papers in each of these techniques, so if I put all the references, there wouldn't be enough space to put the formulas, so forgive me for not adding references to all of these things. The first one that I'm listing here is the peak background split. You essentially assume that you can decompose the density field into large-scale modes and small-scale modes. The small-scale modes are the ones that collapse and produce your galaxies and your halos. The large-scale modes act essentially as a modification of the background. And if you, I'm going to say a few more words about this in a second, but if you calculate the scale-dependent correction in these models, you see that it's linear in FNL, proportional to the essentially scale-independent Lagrangian bias, B minus 1, times some delta C, where delta C is your threshold above which things correspond to collapsed objects, and divided by some function of K, which is essentially the relationship between your density field and your Bardeen potential. So this is essentially the Poisson equation that says that delta is m of k times the Bardeen potential. So you can see here the Laplacian, the transfer function, the growth factor, and a bunch of constants. So this m of k, as k goes to 0, transfer function goes to unity. This gives you a 1 over k squared scale-dependent bias. Now, another derivation that people often use is the so-called you take a Gaussian field in the initial conditions, you look at peaks, and there is a very well-known formula derived back in the 80s, first by Greenstein and Wise, 87, and Lukin, Matarese, and Bonometto, 88, I think, that if you work in the high threshold limit, nu much larger than 1, so you look at high sigma peaks, you can derive a similar relationship for this scale-dependent bias, which now depends on this nu square, which is the parameter you assume to be large. Finally, there is a third type of derivation, which I think was also done in many different ways, but essentially you assume this local Eulerian model in which your tracer, let's say your galaxy, is a local function of the density. So you have a linear bias, you have a quadratic bias, and so on. Okay? And in this model, you can also derive the same effect. So if you calculate your power spectrum, you see that it has a correction at low k that is scale dependent. And this scale dependence is coming through nonlinearities in the bias relationship between your dark matter and your galaxies. So these are the three derivations. In fact, these two models, actually, they are essentially, if you look at the details, they are essentially equivalent to each other. In the sense that if you ignore the fact that these are peaks in the initial conditions, but then you have to move from Lagrangian to Eulerian space, what we are doing by selecting peaks with a high threshold, we are assuming that your galaxy density field is a highly nonlinear function of the dark matter. So in fact, the Gaussian, this peak model is essentially a local bias model only in Lagrangian space. And then people usually assume the way you go from Lagrangian, the initial conditions to the final conditions, is the spherical collapse model. That's again another local model. So at the end, these results are essentially the same as a local Eulerian model if you ignore that in reality going from Lagrangian to Eulerian space is a non-local transformation. But most authors ignore that. Right, what I'm saying is that if you for the moment ignore that you are in Lagrangian space, okay? If you look at, you know. Yeah, sure. But what I'm saying is that if you write what's going on in Lagrangian space, it's a local transformation of your Gaussian field. And then you say, okay, let me go from Lagrangian to Eulerian space. If you use the spherical model, which is a local model, then the dynamics is again local. What you end up is with a local model, okay? So it's just that all the B1s, B2s that you will have in Eulerian model in the peaks model is just functions of mu and the coefficients of the dynamics of the spherical collapse model. Okay, I'll show you later. So essentially, this is when you couple it with the spherical dynamics, this is just the same as this model with prescribed values for B1 and B2 that depend on nu and the vertices that describe the spherical collapse dynamics. So I'm gonna discuss in the following these two models in the same
Explain like very briefly this Greenstein and Wise formula. This is talking about high order correlation functions in terms of 3-point functions.
Yes. So do you have half an hour? But essentially, there's Greenspan and Weiss, you have some density field, right? And so what you assume is that, so if this is delta, you assume that the number density of your objects is essentially some very sensitive function of the density field. Okay, so usually they have something like this. If you look at Greenspan and Weiss, that's essentially what they assume, where this is some positive number. Okay, so that means that these guys will live, you know, in the very high density peaks. Okay, so it's a highly nonlinear transformation of the density field. And if you look at, you know, what this formula is derived in the Luckey-Matarese monomethod framework, essentially what they do a threshold that if you accept, so it's essentially even some sharper cutoff. Okay. And that what it does is essentially determines this coefficient t to be some function of mu. But it's, in reality, it's simple. And then you can relate, for example, that the two-point function of the tracers is some exponential of this, and you have the three-point function and stuff like that. Okay, and then people expand and say, okay, well, this is just whatever. And this is a three-point function evaluated at two points that coincide. Okay? So that's in a nutshell what's going on there. So in fact, that formula that I just wrote, this formula here, so this is the usually Kaiser bias for peaks. And this term is this term that depends on the initial three-point function of your field. If you Fourier transform, if you look at the power spectrum, that additional term, that's what I mean by delta P, you just subtract the scale-independent bias term. It will be, you know, the Fourier transform at the three-point function at two coincident points is just a convolution over the bias spectrum. And so the nice thing about these local models is that they tell you how the scale-dependent bias should be for any model of non-Gaussianity. If you give me the bias spectrum, I can just plug in the bias spectrum, and I should get the scale dependence. And for this particular model that we are considering here, you have to go from delta to phi, so you have to apply these three Poisson equations, so to speak. And so there you have your relationship between delta P and your primordial bias spectrum. So this is a formula we can test in some detail, and I'll discuss in a second how. In the peak background split, on the other hand, if you think about it, it's actually quite different what one is doing. So as I said, you just break, say, the Gaussian field into long and short waves, and then for the local model, you just write phi plus phi square, so you will have, say, Laplacian of phi will be your long wavelength delta, then you will have Laplacian of phi s, and then you will have the nonlinear terms. And essentially what you do is you say, okay, this is the long wavelength density perturbation, and everything else you can treat it as small scale delta. And what you see is that delta now depends not only on delta L, but also depends on phi L, gradients of phi, and Laplacian of phi. Okay? So you have essentially a dependence of your density field on the different derivatives of the potential for long wavelengths. And so that means that because this guy contains all this coupling between long and short waves, is the small scale perturbations, which are how your objects form, will be sensitive to phi on long wavelengths. And that's what creates the scale dependence. So it's not here, it's not really a nonlinearity in the relationship of the bias. It's a different thing. Okay, so now, you know, we have these three derivations. You can actually show that if you're, so in any of these derivations, there is a concept of rare objects, okay? So in this derivation, you will assume that your critical density for collapse is high. Here you will assume your threshold density is high. Here you will assume that your nonlinear bias is high. That's what it means to have a rare object. So in this limit, these three formulas agree with each other. So you can you can, so to show that, you have to assume something. For example, in the case of the peak background split, you assume essentially projector. Then you can show that this combination is nu squared minus 1. So in the high nu limit, that gives you nu squared. For peaks, you can calculate what is B2 for peaks. And this is what I was mentioning to Anshe. You see, for peaks, there is a formula for B2 that is related to the threshold, and this nu 2, which describes a spherical collapse to second order. Again, you see that this combination for high nu gives you nu squared. This also gives you nu squared. So if you go back here, this factor is nu squared, this factor is nu squared, this factor is nu squared. So in the high peak limit, all these formulas agree with each other. And so...
Well, there is an ambiguity there.
Like, we should be scaled kind of, right?
Well, the way we usually think of when we do local Eulerian bias is that we have smoothed already the field of very large waves. Right. And in those large smoothing scales, then B2 goes to a constant.
But it's true, if you smooth them smaller scales, it will start depending on the smaller scale.
So...
But you smooth on scales which are larger than typical scale size.
Yes. So, you know, okay, these three formulas agree, then you would declare victory.
Okay, we understand everything. Even in three different languages. Okay, that's great. Of course, I'm here to tell you that that's not so great. Because if you think about it, the nature of bias in these three different models is actually quite different. Okay? For example, in the peak background split, if you work to linear order, just to make things simple, once you include that your deformation of objects depend on phi, gradient on phi, and Laplacian of phi, then you can derive to first order in perturbation theory that the density perturbation in your tracer has a term that depends on phi and a term that depends on delta. Okay, so the scale dependence here shows as a linear relationship, a linear term that depends on phi. Whereas in the other two models, it comes as I argued, it comes essentially because there is a nonlinear relationship between delta and delta g. Okay, so in this case appears through mode coupling, through quadratic effects, in the peak background split, it appears at the linear level. So clearly, both of these things cannot be right. Okay.
Large and small scale modes, right? Because you already, you know, peak background split, you say, okay, I have mode, and then, you know, depending on the value of long scale mode, this thing will change. So it is coupling of modes. It's just
a right, but it's a different. It's a different kind of coupling, right? Because here it's a coupling between the density and the potential, right? In the other case, it's a delta square coupling. Okay. And so there should be some measurement I can make in my n-body simulation that will be able to tell me which of these two things is right. Okay. So let's do a simple calculation, which is the following. There is this thing that I call the propagator, which is like a Green's function. So if you take any field, in this case we're interested in a bias tracer. So let me take this is a functional derivative of the final galaxy density perturbation with respect to the initial condition. Okay? Now in this case, the initial condition is non-Gaussian. So in the case of a peak background split, I'm just taking what is the dependence of my tracer on the initial perturbations. Because the relationship between these two things was linear, when I take the derivative of phi with respect to delta, I get this 1 over m. And when I take the derivative of this term, it's just B1 times the final dark matter, how the final dark matter depends on the initial density perturbation. That's the usual propagator for a dark matter. And as you take the limit as k goes to 0, this guy goes to the growth factor, where this guy shoots up. Okay, So that gives you a 1 over k square effect. However, for the local models, you have, this should be a delta here, sorry. So you will have, you have a linear term, so it's b1 times g dark matter, the same as here. And then you have the quadratic term, which will give you this derivative of delta with respect to the initial conditions times delta. Now, because the effect is coming through mod coupling, if you calculate this functional derivative, you see this term is just due to second-order perturbation theory with your power spectrum. And because of momentum conservation, this is suppressed at low k. In fact, it goes to zero as k goes to zero. So in this language, the galaxy propagator should go to a constant, whereas here it should be 1 over k squared. So that's a measurement you can do in your simulation to see how the final density field of your tracer depends on the initial conditions, when the initial conditions is Gaussian. And so,
perturbation theory which breaks down on a small scale. So this could
No, I'm looking at low k. So here is okay.
No, but there's mod coupling, as you said. So there's.
Which part will break down? This will not break down.
So the deltas could have very large k. So then.
What?
The delta could have very large k. So it's just the product of deltas have low k, but individual deltas could have large k.
Yes. I mean, this line will give you a k squared over q squared, which gives you some integral that is convergent. So I think it's OK. I don't see. I mean, by momentum conservation, this goes as, will go as k squared over q squared.
So you're claiming that this goes to zero even if you have nonlinear effect, basically. At k equal to zero.
Because essentially, remember, this guy, in any case, this guy is smooth, right? When you are using local Eulerian bias, as I was mentioning, this guy is smooth. So you should imagine that these guys, this is the smooth power spectrum. So I think it's fine.
I'm suspicious of that. It's because that is smoothing. Of course, that's the reason for the problem. Right? That is smoothing because you want delta C to somehow pop out of there. And delta C depends on nonlinear collapse.
No, I don't see the problem. Well, we can talk about it.
So that's one thing that's only delta C. I think
you
too, right?
I
don't see.
But there is no delta C in there.
No, this is a different one. I mean, this thing, if you talk about peaks, depends on you.
You said B2 gives delta C. B2 is delta C.
Yeah,
B2
has
an
independence. Okay. Yeah. You have a question?
So you have this partial derivative here, and I guess I'm trying to understand what's being held fixed. So in the peak background split case, the way I get the first term is that I'm holding the
non-wavelength
field fixed.
Right.
And then when I change the large scale density field, I'm actually changing the small scale post early universe stuff, the pre-structure formation density field. I'm changing that at small scales, and that's varying as part of partial derivative.
Right.
Is that also true in the bottom part, or is that actually a different partial derivative?
Yeah, this is actually different because it's a kind of functional derivative. I didn't want to use the same vector of delta, otherwise it becomes confusing. But it just tells you, you know, how you map from delta g to delta I, essentially. So this is essentially this, all it involves here is the dynamics. Okay, so it could be a spherical collapse. In this case, I'm using perturbation theory, but you can calculate this in many different ways. Okay, so it's just how you go from the initial conditions to the final condition. Okay, so essentially, these kind of models predict g goes to a constant, peak background split predicts it goes as 1 over k squared. Then you measure it, and it goes as 1 over k squared. So here is the measurement for different kinds of FNL. So this is 0, 100, and 500. And in this particular case, it's a redshift 1. So you see that it agrees with the ideas of the peak background split. So
So I'll come back to this later. So let me now move a little move ahead to considering models where primordial non-Gaussianity is non-local. So these are perhaps even more interesting because these are the type of models we expect in single field inflation. There are usually two shapes that people consider in the literature, the so-called equilateral and the orthogonal shape. And they have this type of bispectra in terms of the in terms of the power spectra. Okay? So they have the typical local FNL type of terms. And then they have some terms which are symmetric in the three arguments. And then you have this kind of terms. This is actually an approximation to the real answer, but it's a factorizable answer which people often use. So we are going to take that. You see all terms go dimensionally as p squared. And so we are interested. We want to generate these kind of models. We want to run simulations and do calculations. So the idea, you know, you want to generate a desired bispectrum, which is quadratic in the power spectrum, then all you have to do is to construct a non-local kernel in this case. Instead of being phi squared, it will be some kernel that depends on quadratically on phi, with appropriate non-locality here to reproduce these answers. So,
can you move any bispectrum in such form if k is?
Not really. For example, if this thing will be if it's a very complicated function, you probably will have to work very hard.
But is there standard procedure which you have to follow, or you just?
I don't know. This is
okay.
This is. Standard, well, I would say kind of makes sense to me, but I don't know if there is a more generic. For simplicity, I'm going to assume that there is scale invariance. But in fact, if ns is not equal to 1, it's easy to generalize. But let me consider just a scale invariance. So you introduce a couple of non-local operators. So I'm going to introduce partial of phi, which means in Fourier space multiplied by absolute value of k, inverse Laplacian, the usual thing, minus 1 over k squared, and then inverse partial, which is 1 over absolute value of k. And you can show that the kernel that reproduces the bispectrum, let's take the equilateral case as an example. You can take any of the two. The two, it's just different coefficients, so it's the same thing. So you can show that in this case, you can construct a non-local kernel that gives you the desired bispectrum. And this is easy enough. It's just a couple of FFTs. You can generate initial conditions in your embodied simulations, which we did incorporate into the standard 12-bit initial conditions code. Okay, so now once you have this model, you can actually... you can plug it in into your peak background split formula or your local model formula and predict what will be the scale dependence of the bias. So if you follow the standard peak background split arguments, you will see that instead of having now a 1 over k squared for the equilateral model, you will have something that goes like 1 over k with some correlator which correlates Laplacian of phi with a partial of phi. And again, you see here this essentially this new square. And again, you can remember these local models have a generic prediction for the scale dependence of the power spectrum if you tell them what the bispectrum should be. And this was already done in the literature by Taruya et al., which showed that if you plug in here the equilateral model bispectrum, you recover that this is proportional to the power spectrum itself as k goes to 0. So all it does is to create a scale independent. It just changes the scale independent bias. So according to this formula, again, you start to see differences
that this, in this case, you will predict that it only changes the scale independent part. Here, you will predict the 1 over k bias. So when you run the simulations, so here's an example. Yes?
You mean the local models for modeling it, or not the local non-Gaussian?
I mean phi plus FNL phi squared. Okay?
Yes. No, but here.
Here you mean something different.
Here you mean something else. You talk about local biasing schemes.
Oh,
with
sorry.
Non-local Gaussian. Okay.
Yeah, sorry.
So, these are non-local
Gaussian. I'm getting you confused. Okay, sorry.
No, forward.
Huh?
The other way. Go forward.
Okay,
over
here.
Okay,
so this is what I mean by local bias. Okay, where delta g is a local function of delta. So that, yeah, there is local bias and there is local non-Gaussian, okay? Which is essentially the same, right? Phi plus phi squared. Okay. Then I got you confused again. Huh? Okay, that's the idea. Okay, so
here is one particular realization. So we run a bunch of simulations. This is just one realization, so you can see more or less what's going on. So this is a Gaussian. Black is a Gaussian model. Red is a local non-Gaussianity with FNL equals 100. Green is equilateral with FNL equilateral minus 400. Blue is orthogonal with FNL minus 100. And so I can now take the equilateral model and subtract the Gaussian model, and roughly you should see, I mean, you can already see that this doesn't look like, probably doesn't look like a scale independent bias. So you see some enhancement here, although the data is noisy. So here is the subtraction, okay? So you see for the local case, you see something essentially going as 1 over k squared. For these other guys, you see something that goes as 1 over k. Again, which seems to point to.
Alicia Verdi and Teresa had a paper in which they calculated this integral using the other method, and they found that equilateral produces nothing.
Yes.
Now you claim, you actually claim.
Right, but they use this formula, which produces nothing.
Wow, okay. So now you claim suddenly you can use this to measure.
Right.
Equilateral bias as well.
Looks like, yes.
Wow.
But Romana, why you're losing 1 power of k? Because, I mean, mainly if you look at the three dimension of the pi spectrum, you're looking at the squeeze limit, and usually between equilateral and local, there are 2 powers of k. So I'm just confused why there is this 1 power of k coming in?
I'm not sure what you mean. When you write in the Lagrangian,
if you take the three-point function and you compare the squeeze limit of the two, there is one is suppressed, so the equilateral are suppressing the squeeze limit by 2 powers of the ratio of the k. No? So I was expecting, naively I would expect the same thing, and this would say that there is no k dependence. So you get to the last line.
I'm not sure how to.
So maybe your definition of equilateral is different from.
No, it's the standard definition, and this is the standard definition here. I think this is the standard one.
So
essentially, it's coming. Essentially, this term cancels this when you look at the k dependence, right? Because this one will give you 1 over k squared. So this guy cancels this guy. And this guy has an extra contribution which actually changes sign this one.
Yeah.
And that gives you 1 over k. So it's actually this guy. Right, because so these are 3 different k's. I mean you can probably see it. You can see it essentially it's this term that gives you the 1 over k. You can see because this is external k's and these are the internal k's. So when you do the power counting, you have to be careful between the external momentum and internal momentum. And that's where the difference is coming from.
But you agree anyway. Maybe I'm confused about this one. But in the original, when you write down the orthogonal equilateral, and you compare in the squeeze limit, there is a k squared, no?
Right, but you have to go from this to the density also.
Yeah, it's
anyway. So maybe Yeah, I should know the I should have a better answer for you, but I don't. I mean, this is work in progress, so there are some, still some things that we don't quite understand.
Well, it's true those formulas for bispectral in terms of bispectral, they are approximate in many things.
Yeah, but they all
yes.
they go like a square. So this is what we match the
yes.
to define and this one. So we match the real ones in the sense that they
yes.
match
the formula. And it's also true that this formula, for example, let's see. This formula is also approximate, but it's the leading order that I usually
are these exactly the same formula as the one that they use for CMP constraints?
I'm confused which K we're talking about. So you're saying in the squeezed limit, if I compare the equilateral to the local bispectrum, the ratio of those complicated looking bispectrum formulae. The squeezed one has a k of the short side squared as I make the short side really small.
Mm-hmm. No, the local one will go like 1 over k long, I mean k, the small k cube, while the other one will go like 1 over k. So you lose 2
okay.
k.
I mean, it's still possible that, you know, this is when we add statistics and maybe, you know, this is just a fluke, so we'll see.
This would imply then that the MLB formula is wrong, or like, because that's
well, it assumes that it's essentially a local transformation, right? So,
sorry, what's it?
It assumes what I was saying there, that it's a local transformation of the density field.
Oh, I see.
So once,
oh, right.
I mean, essentially what you're saying is
right.
that once you're doing these kind of models, you're saying that. Because the coupling between long and short waves, you're saying that the formation of structure at
yeah.
this scale
right.
depends on the long wavelength,
right.
so this assumption, you know,
yeah.
at least you have to investigate, okay? So, I think I'm running out of time. I thought I would be...
this part of it.
This part of it. So you can look at cumulative signal to noise for the power spectrum for these models. So again, if you look at the local model, most of the signal is coming from low k, where the bias shoots up, and then quickly you flatten as you go to higher k. So most of the signal is coming from low k. And these other models have a less of a enhancement, and they show also some signal to noise contribution for smaller scales. And this is similar to what people found by just doing one loop perturbation theory on the dark matter. It's just that for halos, it's a bit enhanced. So this seems to agree with what you expect based on just perturbation theory on the dark matter. So now let me consider what happens when you add the bispectrum for a local model. So here now we are making things a little bit more realistic. So this is something that tries to mimic the LRG sample in Sloan. Yeah. Yeah, so this is a very naive thing. So this is essentially, it's not signal to noise for FNL. It's a signal to noise for the bispectrum. So you take essentially bispectrum of the non-Gaussian model, subtract the Gaussian model, and divide by the non-Gaussian error on the bispectrum, and you just sum up over all triangles, okay? So this is up to what k you do the analysis, including all possible shapes of triangles up to a given k. So you see the same thing for the power spectrum. You gain a lot, and then it flattens. Again, this is for a local FNL of 100. And the bispectrum, of course, the signal to noise is suppressed at high scales, at large scales. But then quickly, you gain signal to noise as you go to small scales. So,
bispectrum of dark matter contains all information, right? So all we're seeing in power spectrum of bias tracers is some sort of summation of the bispectrum of the dark
yes.
matter. So essentially, the information of bispectrum should always be larger than information from the power spectrum.
No, because you're saying that this should be always larger than this, and you're
yeah.
confused why this is smaller.
Yes.
because the, you know, the power spectrum is a two-point function, right? So it cannot be sensitive just to the Weiss spectrum at that scale, but some integral of the Weiss spectrum over higher k modes.
Okay. Okay.
And so when, what this guy has here is some integral over this guy.
Okay.
Okay. So that's why. Okay. And because you are integrating, you lose some information, and so the red has more than the blue. So this is telling you more or less, you know, then it becomes a question, you know, where you stop, you know, how much you can trust all these things, what, how complicated is bias, and so on. But roughly speaking, within a factor of two or three, better sigma to noise on the power spectrum. Now, the question is, you know, we were talking about the squeeze limit before and so on. So here is an example. So these are for halos. Sorry,
this is not the same. So this previous plot was for galaxies, which are selected with an HOD to mimic the LRG sample and so on. So this is for halos of different masses, 10 to the 13, 10 to the 14, and 10 to the 14 and above. And this is a comparison of, again, the same thing, cumulative signal to noise in the Weiss spectrum as a function of k. And this is, red is the comparison we'll take in all shapes, and this is only the squeeze shapes. And this is for high mass, and this is for small mass. So there is a lot of information, even though the squeeze Weiss spectrum has a lot of signal, there are not that many triangles which are squeezed compared to all the others, and when you add up everybody compared to just only consider squeezed triangles, you gain quite a bit on the signal to noise.
Yeah,
factor
two, right? It's a factor of three, to depends on regression, depends on.
Yeah. That's not bad, actually.
Yeah. Depends on FNS.
Yeah, depends on cleanest. So you may lose statistical power, but you're not as contaminated by the systematic error, the local bias. Bias effects.
Okay, so let me finish. So there's not many conclusions, but
maybe one should be a bit more careful about the calculation of the local models. We generalize how to implement peak background split on non-local non-Gaussianity models, and the Weiss spectrum has a significant signal to noise, and we are now extending this to the non-local models. All right, thank you.
So I think we have time for a couple of questions, if there's any more.
So it's still quite strange. Why would these other models produce exactly the right answer in such a convincing manner?
The local
yes. The interesting thing is that the peak background split, if you work, let's see what it is. If you keep working, right, there is also a quadratic term coming in the peak background split. And so, in fact, the peak background split is more generic, has the two effects in it. So there are two effects. Now, these two effects become of the same order, only a high nu. But it has to be a very large nu to have that doubling effect. Otherwise, this term dominates over the V2. So in practice, I think it's fine. That's my current understanding of how.
So the other ones only work because they're matching the higher order terms in the terms.
What I'm saying is that the new dependence of this and the quadratic term is different for the halos that we can see. I mean, like 10 to the 14, 10 to the 15, you will see that this term is much larger. In fact, there is a paper, I think, by Porciani and Gian Antonio, which include the two terms. And they see that because they do peak background split to quadratic order and they expand on phi and delta. And they don't say this, but they see both effects. And they see that the one coming from V2 is completely subdominant for all practical purposes. So my interpretation of this is that the local model, you know, by definition, doesn't include this term.
But why does it give the right answer?
No, it doesn't. I mean, if you put just a local model with the news that we can measure, it will be much smaller than the standard answer. Right? Because it's a calculation that only agrees in the high mu limit, but very high.
So
can you explain it a bit more? How can you do this big bang background split for non-local bias? For non-local Gaussian entity.
It's the same calculation, you say the same of phi squared of general.
Yeah, I mean, it's the same calculation, but now you take into account you have these non-local operators. So your conditional mass function now depends on these non-local operators on the long wavelength models. That's essentially what's going on.
All right, well, I guess we should put an extra 2 feet. All right. So while I'm setting up, I just want